Welcome to the news hour. We begin in Sudan, where time is running out for a ceasefire to be renewed. A 72-hour truce comes to an end at midnight local time. Now, those who remain in the capital, Khartoum, have to contend with looting as the prices of basic goods have soared. Traders have complained to police that they're not doing enough to protect their property. While beyond the capital, the conflict has worsened ethnic tensions in the western region of Darfur. Fighting between the army and the rapid support forces rages for a second day in Jenina, the capital of West Darfur. The UN is reporting killings, looting and arson. Evacuees continue to stream out of the country. Hundreds have gathered in Port Sudan, waiting to leave.
We just want a solution to this problem. There are a lot of us here. Help us find a solution to our situation. We just want to get away from this war.
We were living in Khartoum. The situation there is extremely bad, so bad. Thank God we managed to get out. We want to leave safely and go to Jeddah or Syria. We just want to get out of Sudan.
Well, neighbouring countries are also seeing an influx of people. Tens of thousands have fled to places like Chad and Egypt. We have correspondents across the region. Malcolm Webb is at Djibouti Airport for us, where hundreds of people have arrived after fleeing Sudan. But first, let's talk to Hibba Morgan, who's in the Sudanese capital. And of course, Hibba, news that we're focusing on at the moment is about security, the situation there, this whole issue about looting. What is happening right now, as far as you know?
Well, for many people, what's happening is that they're not able to leave their homes, especially after sunset here in the capital, Khartoum. And this all started when there was a break-in in Sijn al-Huda, Huda prison in Omdurman, about 6 days ago, and thousands of prisoners were set free. Now, both sides, the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese army, accuse each other of being behind that prison break and consequent prison breaks, because all five prisons in the capital, Khartoum, were broken into, and more than 20,000 inmates have been able to set themselves free following those break-ins. Now, the Sudanese Ministry of Interior released a statement saying that the prisons and prisoners are their responsibility, but that they're not able to provide the protection to civilians or to be able to take care of the prisoners and bring them back to prisons, because their ministry, their main building, is being occupied by the Rapid Support Forces. And that is making it hard for many people, in addition to the humanitarian situation that is already unraveling in the capital, Khartoum.
The crisis is big. The situation is very tough and internal movements are difficult. We often stand in long queues to get bread. It happened many times where we get bread, but never the amount that my family needs.
Our problem now is how to find cash. We need to take our sick people to hospitals and to remove dead bodies from the streets. We also need food supplies to go to the people and to be available in the shops.
The damage has hit everything. The two parties are fighting each other, and we, the people, will be the biggest losers and the most affected. You can see the situation and see what is happening in front of your eyes.
And Hibba, as we've progressed through the day, there does seem to be this nervousness as we edge towards the end of this 72-hour ceasefire and what could transpire after that.
Well, yes, indeed. People are here in the capital and around the country are waiting to see if the army and the Rapid Support Forces will agree to the 72-hour ceasefire initiative that was proposed by the regional bloc IGAD. Now, that ceasefire also includes the Sudanese army sending an envoy to the South Sudanese capital, Juba, to negotiate with the Rapid Support Forces envoy should the Rapid Support Forces agree to such a deal. Now, the RSF is yet to respond or agree to another 72-hour ceasefire period, but people say that they've looked at the previous ceasefires, they've seen how they've held, and despite the fact that there are some residential areas where it was calm and there was no fighting, they say that there's been artillery strikes in parts of the capital like Omdurman and in the northern part of the capital, as one that continued even this morning with fighting between the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese army, and heavy bombardment around the vicinity of the presidential palace. So people say that this ceasefire that is about to end did not hold in many parts of the capital, Khartoum, and they're waiting to see if the next one will be agreed upon by both sides, and if that, unlike the others, would actually hold.
Hibba Morgan for us in the Sudanese capital. Thanks, Hibba. Let's cross over to Djibouti and to... Oh, pardon me, not yet. Leaving Khartoum is difficult and dangerous. UK military planes have flown citizens out from an airbase north of the capital, but it can take several hours to cover 20 kilometres to Wadi Stena base. Saudi Arabia and India are amongst the countries that have evacuated people from Port Sudan, about 850 kilometres, or a 13-hour drive east of Khartoum. Now, some are making the journey north to Egypt. That's about 1,000 kilometres from the capital, while others are taking an even longer route, about 1,500 kilometres west of the border with Chad. Ebed Idris is in a village near the Chad-Sudan border.
The refugees, mainly women and children, crossed over from Sudan's Darfur area into this part of Chad. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees say they have registered more than 4,000 refugees in Kudron alone, and there are hundreds and hundreds more who are yet to be registered. And they hope to accomplish that in the next few days. Now, what the situation here in this particular camp is desperate. None of the refugees have any permanent structure over their head. There are no structures, no tents, and some of them are virtually living under trees. And they're telling us that the situation here is desperate. A lot of them say they haven't eaten over the past few days. Now, on this particular day, the United Nations and its agencies deployed to this particular area to see the situation for itself. It brought along tons and tons of food items to be distributed to the refugees. And let me show you in particular what's there for them. Now, these are sacks of grains, rice, as well as oil that will be distributed to the refugees all across this particular region. What is not clear is what happens to the other refugees who number in their hundreds who are yet to be registered by the United Nations agencies or relief agencies here. Now, when we panned the camera to this side, this particular family has just received its own share of grains. We can see it's like that's wheat and a few stuff like cooking oil, palm oil, groundnut oil, some flour that could help the family get along until such a time that things improve in this particular camp. Now, the United Nations, the World Food Programme is telling Al Jazeera that they have deployed a lot of food items that will cater for only 20,000 people. And the situation right now in this camp is that they are expecting more than 20,000 people in the days to come. The United Nations has projected between 120,000 to up to 200,000 people crossing from Sudan into this part of Chad, which means that the United Nations and its agencies and other relief agencies need to step up their act in order to cater for these refugees.
Ebed Idris there. Well, we're joined now by Malcolm Webb, who's live for us now at Djibouti Airport. And Malcolm, there's been a steady stream of planes coming and going. So who's managed to arrive at the airport and where are they leaving for?
Well, the US, France, Germany are among the countries that have been evacuating their diplomats and some citizens through Djibouti's international airport and through the neighbouring military airbase. But just in the last few minutes, we've seen a Canadian aircraft land, Canadian military aircraft. Going to stand aside, we can take a look. We can't tell immediately who it was that was getting off it, but it's one of several aircraft that we've seen coming and going over the last few hours, including a Turkish military aircraft. Further down the tarmac is a Japanese civilian aircraft, which is expected to take, I think, the last of the Japanese citizens who've been evacuated from here back home to Japan in the coming hours. And we understand that there are dozens or possibly a few hundred people here within the military base who are waiting for those transport connections to take them back to their home countries. We spoke to some immigration officers here just a short while ago who said about 2,800 people so far have been brought here under these air evacuation programs and that they are ongoing and that more people are expected.
With so many people arriving at the airport, Malcolm, one can only assume at the moment, hearing about what's going on across Sudan, about how difficult the journey must be to actually get to Djibouti.
Well, it's the people who are arriving here have been brought in military aircraft in these air evacuation operations, which have been organised by their governments. And so those aircraft are landing wherever and whenever they safely can in or around Khartoum or in other parts of the country. And then it's about a 2 to 3 hour flight from from Khartoum to here. We've seen with military aircraft from several different countries that we mentioned, but this is a relatively fortunate few hundreds of people that are benefiting from this air evacuation program, initially just diplomats and citizens, but of course the vast majority of people who are trying to flee Sudan, Sudanese or foreigners, are trying to do so by land to the borders with neighboring countries, as we just saw in Ahmed's report, many of them struggling in quite difficult conditions.
Malcolm Webb there for us at Djibouti Airport. Thanks so much, Malcolm. Well, many Sudanese have gathered at the border crossing with Egypt. At the Arkin crossing, families have been spending nights outside in the desert, waiting to be let through. Some say that they've been there for days. Sudan's doctors' syndicate has appealed to the Red Crescent to help those stranded, saying they don't have access to basic health services. Well, many markets in Sudan's capital have been destroyed, and unexploded ammunition poses a danger to those who've remained behind. Al Jazeera's Ahmed Fadel is in the northern part of the capital with more.
We are in the suburb of Shambat, north of Khartoum Bahri. This part of the main fruit and vegetable market was the scene of violent fighting between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces on Saturday. And as you can see, the damage is evident. This truck was carrying ammunition and it exploded during the confrontation. The shrapnel flew everywhere. The biggest danger now is that not all ammunition has exploded. This presents a threat to pedestrians and cars, bearing in mind that some traders and customers are returning to the market. The ammunition is scattered around this area. These munitions could explode at any time due to the high day temperatures, or if cars run over them, or people step on them. These buildings, where police officers used to live, as well as the market, have been severely damaged in the explosions and the fighting, which is considered some of the most violent in this area. Given the situation, authorities need to intervene quickly and bring in teams to dispose of the explosive ordnance safely, because people have started using this road again.
Now, Nasreen Al-Siam and her family are still in Khartoum. She says that they had to move within the city to escape the worst of the fighting.
We had discussions and fights for 3 days before we actually decided to start moving. It was a big responsibility because we were moving in a family. So if anyone got hurt, then the person who actually suggested to move will feel the guilt. If you don't have relatives somewhere else, it's impossible to find an apartment. Even if you found one, it's very expensive, and people were coming out of Ramadan and they did not actually get the payment for the new month because it was not even the end of the month yet. No banks because it happened on Saturday, so no one has enough cash on them. The gasoline and the petrol problem was huge. Most of the cars ran out of petrol in the middle of the way, so people had to either leave them in the middle of the way or try to find some gasoline nearby and buy it with a very high expensive prices.
Let's cross over to our correspondent, Ahmed Idris, who's on the border between Sudan and Chad with the very latest. Obviously, a very difficult situation, Ahmed, for those arriving from Sudan, where you are.
Yeah, certainly. It's a difficult situation for hundreds and hundreds of refugees who are yet to be registered by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and other international donor agencies. We're just at a village not far away from Kufrun, where it is the major distribution center for the World Food Programme and other aid agencies. We realize that dozens of people who have fled the situation in Sudan and are camped out here, out in the open, in makeshift structures, have not been registered and therefore couldn't access some of the aid being delivered to refugees who fled the crisis in Sudan. Now, basically, the situation is such that the United Nations has only organized or rather budgeted for at least 20,000 people in terms of food supplies or food assistance. However, with the current situation, it looks like the agencies here, the United Nations agencies, as well as other donor organizations like the World Food Program, don't have enough to feed the expected number of people who are crossing over from Sudan and into Chad. Earlier this morning, today, there were reports of skirmishes across the border, not 35 kilometers from the town of garrison town of Adre, where people, locals who are reporting hearing gunfire and explosions not far away in the town of Jenina, which is, of course, being contested by both parties in the conflict in Sudan. Initial reports indicate that it is a skirmish between rival ethnic factions, but there are reports that indicate that there is more to it than just ethnic clashes there.
As you say, Emma, there are many hundreds of people arriving where you are by the hour. Just give us an idea of the journey that you've had to make from the last urban area to where you are now, how long that journey takes, because that's an indication of how long the aid is going to take if the UN can actually get it to the locations on the border where they need it most.
Basically, to travel from the capital in N'Djamena to Abéché, you're looking at probably 900 kilometres. So aid delivery will have to be by air. And unfortunately, as it is now, there are reports of shortage of aviation fuel. So the flights are irregular. So that means that definitely the aid is being delivered in trickles and probably at a staggered pace. Right now, when the aid reaches Abéché, it has to come onto places like Fachana. From Fachana, you drive to Adre, which is the biggest border town in this location, and then you have to come forward at least closer to the border to places like Kufron, which is just a few kilometers or hundreds of meters away from the Sudanese border. While we're standing now, we can see the telecommunications mast in Sudan, which is not far from here, by the way. And Kufron is just behind these structures over there. So it means these aid have to be delivered, and they have to cross rivers. The rainy season has just started. And if the rains sort of pour out in a huge amount, that will delay a journey that is supposed to take, like, say, for example, 1 or 2 hours. It will take probably 7 days for aid to be delivered to this particular location. So people are really, really desperate. And believe me, what is happening right here, many people, we're talking about hundreds of people who are living out in the open under tree shades and makeshift structures like the ones you see behind me right here.
Emma, good to get an update from you there on the Sudan-Chad border. Emma Didris for us there. Thank you. We're joined now by David Shin, a former US diplomat with decades of experience in Africa. He's a professor of international relations at George Washington University and joins me now via Skype from Washington, D.C. Mr. Shin, good to have you with us live on Al Jazeera. We really just need to get to the politics here. We've heard that the warring sides in the Sudanese conflict say this is a domestic problem, that they'll sort it out themselves. Yet they have been speaking to international stakeholders, including the US, who secured this recent ceasefire and a window of opportunity for evacuations. It's a step in the right direction, but it's nothing permanent, is it?
No, it's not permanent at all. And the immediate goal is to extend the ceasefire, which may happen, although there have already been violations of the ceasefire. But that's not the answer. The answer is to bring this to a permanent close. And the goal of most of the international community is to eventually transition to a civilian government. That's basically what set off this conflict to begin with. And there's now very little likelihood of moving to a civilian government anytime in the foreseeable future.
And of course, with the mistrust between these two well-armed warring sides, you have an international community, it seems, that can do very little. Yes, there are certain countries that have an avenue of conversation to one side or the other. We know Egypt is in touch with Burhan, the UAE is perhaps in touch with the RSF. How do you read the situation about where the middle ground is and who these two sides might want to talk to if they want to talk to anybody at all?
Well, that's the question, whether they want to talk to anyone at all, and they may not want to talk to anyone. So that means that those countries and organizations that have an interest in ending this problem need to try to talk to them. and to leverage whatever they can in order to get their attention and to get them to change course. I would argue that no single country, no single organization has enough leverage to convince either side to bring this to a halt. But collectively, I think the international community could have an enormous impact on them if it could agree upon a common approach.
What sort of signs should we be looking for now in terms of any ceasefire that could be negotiated in South Sudan? The military leader and the army leader, should I say, Burhan, is willing to, apparently, according to sources, say, yeah, he's willing for another 72-hour ceasefire. The RSF are still an unknown quantity at this moment in time. What would you want to see in terms of movement? What are you expecting to see as a diplomat?
I'd want to see more sincerity from both of these military leaders than I have seen so far. They've made grandiose promises in the past. Both have said that they were willing to transition to a civilian government, but there's a big question whether they have ever been sincere about that. And they need to take some tangible steps in that direction to show their sincerity. And I haven't seen that of late. We saw it 2 years ago when there was, for a period of time, a combination military-civilian government, and things looked hopeful back then. But that came to an abrupt end when the military seized power 2 years ago and basically a military coup. And since then, we haven't really seen any sincere willingness by either side to move towards a civilian government.
In your opinion, how important is IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development? It consists of Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Djibouti, Uganda, Eritrea. They all surround Sudan. They are all neighbours. They all work together on economic and environmental projects together. But they also have a political connection too. And I wonder, in that grouping, do you think there is anybody that has, you might say, some sway, some power to actually get these sides to talk to them?
Probably not. It's important to bring the Intergovernmental Authority on Development countries into this discussion. They should be a key part of it. They can bring moral suasion into the discussion, but they don't have much tangible leverage. Now, the leverage comes from those countries and organizations that have some economic clout in Sudan. That would mean, direct military clout. That would mean countries like the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, the Russian Wagner Group, which is closely aligned with the Rapid Support Forces, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, those countries that hold the debt of Sudan. All of these countries collectively need to come together and put pressure on both sides to bring this to a halt.
It'll be interesting to see what does happen in the next few hours, very important next few hours. David Chin, thanks so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thank you.